School's out today for many kids in Hawaii. It's the second of 17 furlough Fridays the state has imposed to close a big gap in its education budget. Hawaii has instituted one of the most drastic public school teacher furloughs in the country. Parents are up in arms. State officials are scrambling. From Hawaii Public Radio, Ben Marcus reports.
At Kahala Elementary in Honolulu, kids are herded along a shaded walkway into a school's cafeteria. It was in this cafeteria several weeks ago that Joe Curran, mother to a first grader, banded together with other moms worried about looming furlough Fridays.
And from that meeting, a little voice, someone sitting next to me, said we should really march on the Capitol.
They formed Hawaii Education Matters, and last Friday they indeed marched on the Capitol.
Some 700 parents and children rallied at the state capitol today to protest cuts to education on furlough.
State capitol turned into an outdoor classroom on this first furlough Friday.
Protests were also taken to court. Two class action lawsuits were filed against the state. Eric Seitz is one of the lead attorneys. He's encouraged by the protests because he says it will take public outrage to move state government.
The outcome of this whole issue is going to be a defining moment in the political life of this community and for a long time to come. And it's very critical, I think, that we resolve this problem sooner than later because the long-term effects are going to be horrible.
Hawaii students already test well below the national average. More than 60% of island schools haven't met adequate yearly progress under the federal education program known as No Child Left Behind. Garrett Taguchi is chair of the Hawaii Board of Education. He says there just weren't many other options after a 14% cut to education funding this year. He says officials warned the public months ago this was coming.
And the public didn't pay attention. And, you know, understandably, because it probably wasn't happening, maybe people thought it wasn't going to happen. But we knew it was going to happen. And so when it finally did happen, the public's reaction is not surprising, but it is sadly maybe a bit too late.
After the protests last Friday, Governor Linda Lingle, who signed off on the furloughs, backpedaled and said she now thinks they were a mistake. And the state Senate has formed a special committee to look into options to restore the lost instructional time. Again, Chair Taguchi.
I'm very pessimistic that anything will be done, but on the other hand, I'm optimistic that I'll be proven wrong.
Until lawsuits are settled or state government can work out a compromise, parents of the more than 170,000 public school kids across the state are stuck, wondering what to do with their kids on furlough Fridays. Back at Kahala Elementary, Jo Curran has decided to put her son Max in a learning enrichment program.
You know, classroom time is just not something that can be compromised. It's just as simple as that. It's not a debating tool.
But at $30 a day, it's not something everyone here can afford. For NPR News, I'm Ben Marcus in Honolulu.
One year ago this week, the U.S. government bailed out some of the country's largest banks. The government has actually made some money off of that, about $10 billion so far. The situation is less clear, though, when you look at the auto bailout. Our Planet Money team has been checking in on our investment in General Motors. David Kestenbaum has the story.
In case you've lost track, U.S. taxpayers have put a total of $50 billion into General Motors. Initially, the aid was supposed to just help GM weather the storm, but as we all know, the storm won, and General Motors went through bankruptcy. The new GM CEO, Fritz Henderson, recently sat down with my colleague Adam Davidson and ran through the company's financials.
We talk about debt, preferred, and common. Okay?
You're writing that down for radio listeners.
Sorry. This helps me think about it. Yeah. So the debt to the U.S. and the Canadian government is about $8 billion. And it's 6.7 and 1.3.
What Henderson is saying there is that as a result of the bankruptcy restructuring, General Motors only owes the U.S. government $6.7 billion. Now, that does not mean the rest of the $50 billion the U.S. invested is gone, because guess who owns 61% of this brand new General Motors company? We do, the taxpayers. That's what we got out of the bankruptcy. So the question is, what is that stock worth? Or more importantly, what will it be worth? The stock isn't traded publicly yet, so there's no easy way to put a price on it. Henderson says business is looking okay. September sales were abysmal compared to a year ago, he says, but people still bought GM vehicles. The company captured one-fifth of the U.S. market.
In an absolute sense, we weren't particularly happy given how weak the industry was, but our share performance was actually the best we had this year. And I'd say so far October is shaped up okay too. So, good initial encouraging signs.
By all accounts, General Motors was a mess before the bankruptcy. Stephen Ratner, who led the U.S. Auto Task Force, describes his experience in the current issue of Fortune magazine. Ratner writes, quote, "Everyone knew Detroit's reputation for insular, slow-moving cultures. Even by that low standard, I was shocked by the stunningly poor management that we found. The top brass," he wrote, "were sequestered on the uppermost floor behind locked and guarded doors with elevator cards that would take them directly to their private garage." So, will the taxpayers get their money back? John Casessa with the Casessa Shapiro Group says maybe. Casessa is a longtime auto analyst.
GM would have to have a very impressive turnaround and, start to earn a lot of money, $7, $8, $10 billion a year.
Recently, General Motors has been losing billions. Still, Casessa says the company is in a much better financial situation now after bankruptcy. And he expects the car market will come back.
Sales are running at an extremely, extremely low rate. And I am well aware of all the reasons why the economy may be weak for some period of time. But if sales were to bounce back just to 13 or 14 million, which is still well below the historical sales level, they could start to make a lot of money.
Here are some sobering numbers, though. At its peak, if you took all of General Motors' stock and added it up, the company was worth $57 billion. Remember, taxpayers now own a little over half the company. So if we want all our money back, General Motors will have to be worth even more than it was in those happier days. Jeremy Anwyl is CEO of Edmunds.com, which analyzes the auto industry, and he basically agrees with Casessa's analysis. It will be hard for taxpayers to be made whole. But if you ask him, was the bailout a bad idea? He says it's hard to know.
I mean, I'm of two minds, because on the one hand, I'm kind of old school. I'm not sure if the government should be investing in business like this. On the other hand, I think the consequences here would have been pretty dire. So sometimes you just kind of hold your nose and do the right thing, even though, in principle, it's probably something we shouldn't have done.
It's possible, he says, doing nothing might have been worse. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Halloween is tomorrow, so we're ending this hour with a ghost story. It comes from musician and commentator Chris Butler.
I bought Jeffrey Dahmer's childhood home in Bath, Ohio. I'll let that sink in for a second. If your first reaction is, ew, that's perfectly understandable. Jeffrey Dahmer was one of America's most notorious serial killers, and his rampage lasted from 1978 to 1991. He confessed to killing at least 17 young men, many of these murders involving torture and cannibalism. I bought the house, though, not for some kind of perverse goth thrill, but because I needed a place in woodsy, suburban northeastern Ohio where I could make a loud musical racket and not bug my neighbors. And this mid-century modern house on 2 acres of forested hillside was ideal. I was instantly charmed the first time I pulled in the driveway and really puzzled why such a fantastic pad had gone unsold for 6 months, even though it was priced way below anything comparable in the area. Charm turned to creeped out when 24 hours after I first saw the place with my real estate agent, Greg Greco, he told me of the house's grisly provenance.
I remember we came to look at it the first time. That evening, the listing agent called and said, "We have a disclosure issue." I knew Jeffrey Dahmer had been in this area, but they have a water leak somewhere they're going to get fixed. Right. That's usually what we talk about. And then she said there was a murder in the home, that it was of significant notoriety, and we needed to disclose it. And my first thought was, how am I going to tell? How am I going to tell Chris this?
Because Jeffrey Dahmer did commit his first murder here. A hitchhiker named Stephen Hicks, who he lured back to the house with promises of drugs and alcohol, and then clubbed with a barbell after Hicks said he wanted to leave. Dahmer later dismembered Hicks's corpse in the house's crawl space. Now, I won't lie. There was a twisted kind of cachet attached to living in a house where a famous homicidal maniac kicked off his career. I didn't broadcast this, but it could be useful. If the party chatter stalled on dull topics, I had a surefire conversation stopper and subject changer. And then someone would inevitably ask, correction, someone educated and worldly and who you'd think would know better would inevitably ask, have you seen any, you know, ghosts? The truth is, the vibe here is fantastic. The house didn't kill anybody, and I haven't seen any ghosts. I'm not superstitious or a believer in the paranormal, but after months of people freaking out about where I was living, I did begin to wonder if there might be some leftover bad business in the place. As it turns out, in northeastern Ohio, there is lots of interest in the paranormal. Ghost hunts are offered at creepy sites all around the region, and I'd been approached by several psychics and paranormal clubs who wanted to bring audio recorders and video cameras over to see what they could scare up.
Well, we're really not hunting ghosts.
No.
I really don't know how to label myself. I mean, we do some investigating.
We document.
We document.
We have cameras and tape recorders.
We're documenters.
And video cameras. And
how about a sleuth?
Meet Ro York and Cheryl Canarum, who wanted to organize just such a paranormal investigation at my house. Their specialty is gathering electronic voice phenomena, or EVPs, ethereal voices or sounds that recording devices pick up when you thought you were just taping little Johnny's 6th birthday party. Now, please note that these women are not flakes or fools either. In fact, they come across as skeptics most of the time, yet both have had many experiences that they can't explain. So let's have a ghost hunt. According to Rowan Cheryl, the key to a successful hunt is picking a significant date. May 21st, Jeffrey Dahmer's birthday, was perfect. The house and its infamous crawl space, where Dahmer had dismembered Hicks's corpse, was wired up with night vision video cameras, digital audio recorders, still cameras on timers, plus I'd hung microphones in key spots and plugged them into my computer's hard disk recording system. In short, if it goes so much as past gas, we document it. There were three possible outcomes of this evening's experiment. One, they'd get nothing. Two, they'd get something vague, something that might be, could be, but inconclusive or at least explainable by natural or mechanical causes. Or three, they'd get a recording that irrefutably proved the existence of the afterlife. And the house would be overrun with the curious and kooky, and my quiet, semi-hermit life here would be ruined. With all the electronics in good working order, repeat, with all the electronics in good working order, we left the house empty for the evening. And for the most part, this is what we recorded. Hours and hours of the house's ambient noise, which admittedly doesn't make for riveting radio. When I came back to the house in the early morning, Ro and Cheryl were having technical problems.
May I have a progress report, please?
I came up to my camera, which was sitting in your living area by your in front of your fireplace, and it was off, which I expected it to be. I expected the film to have ran out and or the battery to die, one of the two or both. And I looked at the battery and I saw there were quite a few minutes left. So I got a little suspicious. I'm thinking the tape didn't run out, I bet. And I pulled the tape out and I showed it to you. There was only 40 minutes of tape used. I don't know why it went off. The battery still had over 300 minutes and only 40 minutes of tape had taped.
In fact, all the gear that was in the vicinity of the crawl space had malfunctioned. It was working when we left, but machines stopped, batteries went dead, and my computer system showed a 2 gigabyte sound file, a huge file, which refused to open. Did cranky spirits not want us to find them? Was it our technical ineptitude, or was our sophisticated equipment just too embarrassed to be part of something as silly as a ghost hunt? Ro and Cheryl didn't find anything conclusive on the few machines that had functioned properly, but it really didn't matter, because I know the house is haunted. Maybe not by ghosts, but by something much, much scarier. It's haunted by reality, by the unbelievable horror that humans are capable of. Jeffrey Dahmer's ghost does exist. He haunts my neighbors who can't overcome their fears and come inside for a friendly cup of coffee. And he haunts his victims' families every minute of every day.
One more thing. And Rowan Sherrill didn't know this, but I'd hidden a secret recorder in the house to see if I could catch someone sneaking back in to fiddle with the equipment. And in the middle of the hours of house ambience and the refrigerator cycling on and off and maybe a mouse or two, there was something. A funny noise, probably nothing, easily and rationally explained. I mean, you don't believe in ghosts, do you?
I just moved in my new house today. Moving was hard, but I got squared away. Bells started ringing and chain ran loud. Knew I'd moved in a haunted house.
That's commentator and musician Chris Butler.
Nothing was gonna drive me away. When I seen something that give me the creep. Had a one big eye and a two big feet. Stood right still and I did the...
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
A NASA satellite that's been monitoring the Earth's polar ice caps is about to die. That satellite has helped show that some of the Earth's largest ice sheets are melting, which could lead to a dramatic rise in sea level. But scientists won't know for sure without more data. A replacement for the dying satellite is years away, so NASA has begun monitoring polar ice using airplanes. NPR's John Hamilton has more.
Punta Arenas, Chile, is as close as you can get to Antarctica and still find an airport for a big jet. So for the past couple of weeks, a NASA DC-8 has been taking off from that airport and heading south.
There's a lot of ice down there.
Seeley Martin of the University of Washington is the chief scientist for NASA's Ice Bridge mission. He spoke from his hotel in Punta Arenas after an 11-hour flight. Martin says that from the plane, you can't see the glaciers changing.
But satellite radar observations and satellite altimeter observations show that these are losing a fair bit of mass. Now, it's not a lot of mass. We're talking about a millimeter sea level rise per year, but it's something to be concerned about.
And measurements from the DC-8 will help scientists figure out whether the process is accelerating. The NASA plane already spent several weeks taking similar measurements in Greenland during the Northern Hemisphere summer. NASA's Thomas Wagner says Ice Bridge is an effort to continue the work of the dying satellite, called ICESat.
The satellite's now 7 years old. It was only planned to really work for about 3 years.
The lasers it uses to measure polar ice are just about burned out. Wagner says data on Antarctica are especially important because it's been studied less than Greenland and because it's so big.
You're talking about something the size of North America covered with miles of ice. Okay, it's like over 90% of the world's fresh water. You're flying over one of the tallest mountain ranges in the world, and it's just little peaks in some cases peeking up, from the ice.
There's enough frozen water to raise sea level dozens of feet if it melted. And Wagner says there's growing evidence that something is happening to the ice in several enormous Antarctic glaciers.
One of these glaciers has lost 9 meters of ice a year. So the math works out so that these glaciers wouldn't be around if they continued to lose ice at this rate.
That suggests the melting started pretty recently, perhaps because of global warming. Scientists say the Ice Bridge mission is an imperfect fix for a lost satellite. An airplane scans only a small area, while the satellite sees big chunks of the globe. But Seeley Martin says the DC-8 carries instruments that offer much more detail about what's going on than a satellite could. And he says ICESat has already identified the regions that could trigger a rapid rise in sea level.
It seemed important to keep an eye on these regions that are sensitive and subject to rapid change, so we wouldn't wake up in 5 or 6 years and have an oh my God moment. You know, what happened?
One of these sensitive regions is called Pine Island, though it lacks either pine or an island. It's where a massive glacier is sliding into the Amundsen Sea. Martin says a special radar on the DC-8 is allowing scientists to study the bottom of the ice, which helps them look for signs that the glacier is accelerating.
We're also interested in the ice tongue, which is sort of the cork in the champagne bottle. It sort of serves to sort of help hold back the ice.
The tongue sticks out into a bay. Martin says if scientists can figure out how much liquid water is under the frozen tongue, they'll have a better idea whether this particular cork is about to pop. Martin says it's places like Pine Island, where ice moves from land to sea, that cause oceans to rise. He says that's because sea ice is like ice in a glass of water.
As the ice melts, the level of the water in the glass isn't going to change.
But it's a different story with land ice. When that goes into the sea, it's like someone dropping a new ice cube into your glass.
So the floating ice isn't going to really change the level of the water in your glass, but the addition of ice to the glass is.
And the miles of ice piled up on Antarctica represent a very large ice cube. John Hamilton, NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. This week, we're marking the 40th anniversary of the Internet. And today, there's big news for people who surf the web in other parts of the world. ICANN, the organization that oversees Internet domain names, has finally approved the use of non-Latin characters in web addresses. That means that people who speak Mandarin, Arabic, Hindi can name websites in their own languages. Today's decision was almost a decade in the making, and it's another example of the global reach of the Internet. As part of our series, The Net at 40, we are profiling three international stars of the web, three bloggers. In a moment, we'll go to London and Shanghai. First, though, to Mumbai.
My name is Meenakshi Reddy Madhavan, and I live in Bombay, also known as Mumbai, in India. And I've been blogging for the last 5 years. I would say, on average, I get about 1,000 visitors a day. I've got about nearly 1.5 million readers in the last 5 years. It's called The Compulsive Confessor. I was having a conversation with my mother one day, and she's like, you know what your problem is? You're a compulsive confessor. And I was like, oh my God, that is the perfect name for my new blog. Bombay is a brilliant city, but only if you're a young person. Almost all my friends are people like me who've migrated from other cities, live here, to work here, you know. We go out together. We have a core group that meets almost every night. It's people in the same boat getting together, and people are really friendly. What I do is I write the way I talk. So sometimes if I'm really angry, the F word or something would slip out. So when I'm talking, I try to talk as naturally as I can. I don't resort to hiding what I'm saying under any kind of layers of language. I don't know whether you'd call the subjects I write about controversial. I do write a lot about injustices that I feel are happening. I'll write about, if I read a news item that particularly gets me, I'll talk about that, but not in great detail. I do write about sex, yes. My boyfriend did get a little upset about the blog, but then he read it, and then he was like, okay, you know, it's not like you're saying anything that's not true. So sometimes if I'm saying something particularly sensitive, I will run it past him first. It's okay if I write about this, and he just like rolls his eyes and says, okay, if you must. I get a lot of complaints. If you search Google blog search and you look for my name, you would see a lot of people like getting really angry with the lifestyle I was leading or the stuff I was doing. For instance, I wrote a post about going to the gynecologist one day. And man, the next morning I woke up and it's all over the blogosphere. Oh my God, she went to the gynecologist. I'm like, what's the big deal about going to the gynecologist? People do that all the time. I'm not talking about anything that I haven't seen happening. But at the same time, I guess I'm pretty stubborn. I do like to take some things head on. And so when I write about women smoking and drinking, in particular me, I don't really write about other people. I'm sort of doing a dual thing. I'm saying this is the kind of people that they are in the country. Get used to it.
I'm Vicky Barker in London, where there are arguably only two types of politicians, those who admit they follow the Guy Fawkes blog and those who do but won't admit it. The homepage, orderorder.com, features an animation of Big Ben being blown to smithereens. The content has performed similar demolition jobs on several political careers.
Guy Fawkes is celebrated every November 5th over here for trying to blow up Parliament. Some people say he's a baddie, some people say he's a goodie, but there's one thing everyone knows, he was anti-politicians and has a strong brand name.
5 years ago, four centuries after his namesake, Paul Staines created his online alter ego. The newly bankrupt businessman suddenly had a lot of time on his hands. A libertarian who once organized acid house parties, in his student days he described himself as Thatcher on drugs, Staines consciously set out to become Britain's Matt Drudge. Like Drudge, he was initially dismissed as a know-nothing outsider, a purveyor of unfounded rumor and gossip. Like Drudge, he's been able to tap into a rich vein of disgruntlement among underpaid, overworked underlings.
My stories tend to come from junior people. Interns, researchers.
He thinks the blog's chatty style, full of accounts of bumping into people in pubs, of getting drunk, of being thrown out of meetings, makes him more approachable to his mostly young sources. Guy Fawkes now registers 100,000 hits a week. It's consistently rated Britain's most influential political blog. Staines works out of a cramped office in Clerkenwell, a Dickensian corner of East London. He readily acknowledges that he, a non-journalist with a somewhat checkered professional past, could never have reached the heights he has without the Internet. He calls that his strength.
I have no intention of going anywhere else in politics or in a career in journalism, so I'm kind of free in that sense.
Staines also believes he's carrying on in the tradition of the 17th and 18th century pamphleteers who did their blogging with that new technology, the printing press. Times are changing in Britain's Parliament. Opinion polls suggest the next election could bring the Conservatives to power. The right-leaning Staines is torn.
I hope it'll be fun. Whether I'll have quite the vitriol remains to be seen, but I've got my disappointment in early. I think I'll have enough material to work on.
After all, he says, he knows where all the bodies are buried. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
This is Louisa Lim in Shanghai, and a native Shanghainese, Han Han may just be the world's top blogger. His blog has had 280 million hits. And last year, he became, by some estimates, the most read blogger in China. He's a 26-year-old high school dropout turned author turned racing driver. Now his brand of scathing sarcasm has become the online voice of a generation, fighting injustice with irony. He says the internet has profoundly changed the way young Chinese think.
After information was liberalized, a lot of readers no longer trusted the state-run media. The lies they used to believe in were uncovered. So China now has two different languages, the language of state-run television stations and the language of young people.
The pop music on Han Han's website might soften the mood, but what he writes is far from mellow. A typical post muses on today's class structure in China. Only four classes exist, he opines. The poor, those slaving to pay their mortgages, the rich and the super rich. On government officials, he says 99% of their talk is bull, the other 1% is nonsense. Government officials are among his favourite targets.
I take liberties with them and satirize them because they're an extremely funny, extremely stupid group of people. And I hope I'm someone who can tell right and wrong.
One of his most controversial posts, and there have been many, was inspired by the fire which destroyed part of the new headquarters of China Central Television. He called CCTV evil for telling lies, persecuting intellectuals, and concealing wrongdoing. The post was soon deleted by censors. Han Han says his posts seldom get censored, and it doesn't really bother him anyway.
I live in this country. I know the bottom line. Being angry is meaningless, so why not try to be happy? If they delete the post, then you write another and see if they delete that. And if they do, then you just write another one.
Fight for every inch of freedom, sings Han Han in a pop song he released. Once a teenage novelist, Han Han is coming of age online. Now he's being described as a public intellectual, an opinion former whose agenda is seeping over into the mainstream media. And he's confident in the power of the World Wide Web. Allowing the internet in China, he writes on his blog, must be our government's biggest regret. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
And our story about Indian blogger Meenakshi Reddy Madhavan was produced by NPR's Phil Reeves. You can hear more stories about The Net at 40 this weekend on All Things Considered. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. The White House issued a progress report late today on the government effort to stimulate the economy. Vice President Joe Biden, who has the stimulus portfolio, says that so far, more than 640,000 jobs are directly traceable to stimulus spending.
The Recovery Act is operating as advertised, but wasn't advertised as the only horse to carry the sleigh to get us out of this ditch, but to play an incredibly important role.
The vice president says the Obama administration is on track to meet its promise of creating or saving some 3.5 million jobs by the end of next year. Well, NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley joins us now to talk about the new numbers. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you, Robert.
How did the administration arrive at this figure of more than 640,000 jobs?
Well, as part of their transparency effort, the White House has asked every local government, private contractor, nonprofit group, anybody who got a sizable chunk of stimulus dollars was supposed to report back to the government how many people did you hire or keep on the payroll with that money. And they added all that up and came up with the improbably precise figure of 640,329 jobs that are directly traceable to the stimulus. About half of those are teachers. They're police officers who would have been laid off, but for the federal government backfilling local coffers. About 80,000 of the jobs are in construction. The White House is really trying to answer the question, you know, where are the jobs for all this money that we've spent?
But White House economists have also said that they think the stimulus is responsible for at least 1 million jobs. Why the different numbers?
Well, this is really two different ways of accounting for it. I've explained how the 640 figure is really just a matter of going out and counting actual bodies. But that doesn't cover everything. In fact, the people that had to report on this money account for only about $160 billion of the $340 billion that had been spent as of last month. It doesn't include the money, for example, that went to workers in the form of tax cuts. It doesn't include the extra unemployment benefits. And it doesn't include indirect spending. If, for example, a contractor that's building a new road went out and bought some asphalt, and then the asphalt company had to hire somebody. Doesn't include that. So what the White House economists do is they take a model and basically say, well, if we've pumped $340 billion into the economy, we just reckon it's created about 1 million jobs. And these aren't necessarily jobs that you can follow the dollar directly from the U.S. Treasury into someone's paycheck, but it's not an unreasonable estimate of how many jobs are out there.
Well, we have these numbers coming out of the White House today. Earlier in the week, we had numbers showing gross domestic product was increasing in the last quarter, but the unemployment rate keeps going up. It's nearing 10% now, and every month we get a report of hundreds of thousands more jobs lost.
Yeah, and that's the real challenge here, both for the people who are out of work and also for the politicians who are trying to explain what's going on here. You have to remember those monthly jobs numbers are net. Every month, a lot of people are hired, a lot of people are laid off. You add them together, and if the layoffs outnumber the new hires, then you have a negative bottom line, and that's what we've had really since the beginning of last year. Now, the pace of the job loss has slowed considerably, and the administration wants some credit for that. At the same time, the president and his team always want to acknowledge the real economic suffering out there, and Vice President Biden did that today.
My grandpop used to have an expression from Scranton. He'd say, and I mean this literally, it wasn't viewed as a joke. He'd say, Joey, when the guy in Dixon City, a small town above Scranton, is out of work, it's an economic slowdown. When your brother-in-law is out of work, it's a recession. When you're out of work, it's a depression. And it's a depression for millions of American people. And we're not going to be satisfied until we see a net creation in jobs in every monthly report. But we're moving in the right direction.
And that's the line the administration is trying to walk here, saying our efforts are helping, but we understand it's not good enough yet.
Now, Republicans in Congress, who generally voted against the stimulus package, have complained that it is not working to create jobs. How have they responded to the White House numbers today?
Well, it's interesting. The vice president was flanked today by a Republican governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger of California, as well as a Democratic governor. And Schwarzenegger said, you know, this shouldn't be a partisan issue. It shouldn't be about Republicans or Democrats. It should be about jobs. But here in Washington, it is very much a partisan issue, and the Republicans in Congress make hay every month when the job numbers come out and say the stimulus isn't working, and why don't we do it our way?
What does this say about the possibility of a second stimulus package?
Well, the administration says it's willing to consider all sorts of options and fine-tuning and extending some of the parts of the stimulus that are due to expire, but they're not really talking seriously about a big new multi-billion-dollar stimulus.
NPR White House reporter Scott Horsley. Thank you, Scott.
My pleasure.